Today's great life was a man who held two of the three great offices of state and who spent 5 years as the President of the European Commission. But arguably, his sweetest victory came at a by-election in 1982.
Books, William George, Public Safety, Democratic Monarchist, White Resident, 5.
Among the standard colourful array of by-election candidates,
Protestant Crusade Against Papal Visit, 388.
There were two men with very nearly the same name.
Jenkins Roy Harold, Social Democratic Party, 282. Jenkins, the Right Honourable Roy Harris, Social Democrat Liberal Alliance candidate, 10,106.
It was, of course, the second of these who won the Glasgow Hillhead seat.
Elected to serve in Parliament is the Right Honourable Roy Harris Jenkins.
My guest here, who's chosen Roy Harris Jenkins, is Polly Toynbee, journalist, broadcaster, and since last year, president of the British Humanist Association. Polly, what do you remember of that by-election?
It was an amazing event for those of us who were in the SDP Liberal Alliance at the time. It was a remarkable victory. And I think it was his vision that really saw that politics needed to change and still does. Fewer and fewer people vote in every election. He saw that and saw that the way forward would be a system where people could join smaller parties, have a chance of having their voice heard, where governments would be coalitions and have to work together. That's still the progressive, optimistic vision a lot of us still have, but we're a long way from achieving it.
But forgive me, this is all, in a sense, quite policy-oriented, and perhaps that's what you really admire about him. But did you also admire him as a man?
I enormously admired Roy Jenkins. He was clever, funny, wise. He's often thought of in public as being rather stiff and rather pompous, but he wasn't at all. In fact, in some ways, I think he was curiously slightly insecure. But I wanted to choose a politician because I admire politicians. I don't think you can write about it well unless you actually admire politicians, and these days they are so despised and so reviled.
You don't think there's any justice in Harold Wilson's verdict, more socialite than socialist?
Oh, he had a tremendous socialite side. He had a taste for duchesses and the high life.
But do you?
Do I have a taste for duchesses and dukes? No, not really. And I don't think I totally understood that aspect of his life.
Because you can be a little bit fierce at times. He was never really fierce, was he?
Once, when things were really bad in the National Committee of the SDP, he thumped the table. He went bright red, pointed a finger at me and said, Madame Defarge.
Also here we have two first-rate witnesses to Roy Jenkins' life. Lord Tavern, who as Dick Tavern was one of Roy Jenkins' junior ministers, and Lord Steele, David Steele, former leader of the Liberal Party, which was, of course, intimately involved in the alliance with the SDP. David Steele, what do you remember of the man?
Well, there's one adjective that Polly didn't use, which I would add to her list, and that is courageous. I remember halfway through the campaign, the polls were predicting that he wasn't going to win, and we had a very desperate meeting, I remember, in the Pond Hotel, which was his headquarters in Glasgow, when things were looking very gloomy. He said to me, look, you know, you're a local, I'm not. You better come in and spend the last couple of days here. And we had a huge eve of poll meeting. I remember it still because the windows of the modern school were open on either side of the hall and there were more people outside than there were inside. And he just blazed trails wherever he went. So I would add courageous to that list.
What sort of figure did he cut as a man? When I first met him, he was rather slim and dashing. When
slim.
You later saw him, yes, he was quite slim to begin with, and then he sort of broadened out as time went on. And certainly by the time he came back from Brussels, he was the sort of corpulent Roy that one saw later. Although I was very surprised when I was in Brussels on one occasion staying with him, that he said that he used to spend the mornings jogging round the park.
Extraordinary mental picture.
Yes, extraordinary picture. But he was a man of great charm and warmth, and everyone sort of felt this.
Dick Tavern, you've said that Roy Jenkins was one of only two great post-war British politicians. The view comes as a surprise, I should think, to some.
Well, because I think he was unique in having this combination of talents, which Polly's referred to, of being someone who had a major impact on events and also in Europe as president, where he launched the European monetary system, with his Home Office reforms, which changed Britain into a more civilised society, in my view. And he was master of the House of Commons. He was a great orator. People forgot that later because he lost some of his powers.
But above all, of course, what he will be remembered for is that he is the man who created the 1960s revolution.
Absolutely.
It is quite extraordinary that in less than 2 years in the Home Office, he helped David Steele bring in the Abortion Act, which couldn't have happened without him. Homosexual law reform, stopped corporal punishment in prisons, prepared for the abolition of theatre censorship, which he cared a lot about. Many fewer fine defaulters
sentences.
Exactly. Much more legal aid. Everything actually rather the opposite of what New Labour's done. He emptied the prisons, New Labour has filled them.
But in fact, there's one more point which people hadn't realised. At the end of his time, he not only received the accolade of all the sort of liberal-minded people and the reformers, he also had a special presentation made to him by the Police Federation. So the police were some of his greatest fans.
This is one of the three great areas of his life that I want to concentrate on. His work as Home Secretary, of course, his time in Europe, and lastly, his attempt to break the two-party mould. But first, a bit of background. Jenkins was born in 1920 in what is now Gwent. His father was a miner who won a union scholarship to Ruskin College and, after a return to the pits, became a union official and, in 1935, a Labour MP. We have a clip here of Roy talking on Radio 2 in 1985. I was especially interested in the detail about his father.
He was a good speaker. I admired his speaking. He didn't have great Welsh hwyl, as it's sometimes called, and he wasn't, in a sense, terribly Welsh.
But on the other hand, wasn't he sent to prison for what in effect was rabble-rousing with speech-making?
Well, he'd only won rabble-rousing. If you knew him, you would know that wasn't so. He was sent to prison. He always firmly believed that he was wrongly convicted and that he had, in fact, been trying to quieten a riot. And though I was only six at the time, can't judge directly, I would totally believe this, knowing him very well, because he was an extremely pacific figure.
Polly, did you know about that?
His cousin says that his mother was terribly distraught about it and never spoke about it again, and it was somehow regarded as not respectable, whereas these days you might think it was very heroic to go to prison for 3 months in the time of the general strike defending miners. But I think it was probably true he was trying to calm them down rather than rabble-rouse them.
But I noticed that the interviewer there asked what seemed a perfectly reasonable question, and Roy Jenkins sounded a little bit miffed that he'd been asked the question about his father, as though he was anything but proud of
him. Oh, he was very proud of his father, and I think very fond of him. And he was often mocked for having seemed to have come a long way, the way he spoke, the way he presented himself, that sort of orotund delivery. But I think he felt strongly about his Welsh roots and his family and his father.
How wealthy were his family? Where did he gain his taste for comfort and civilised society?
They weren't wealthy, but having become an MP, they'd become sort of middle class, as you do by definition when you become an MP. And they did have a servant, and this was often in Labour's most left-wing days hurled at him as he wasn't really a working-class mining stock at all.
Was he a snob, David, in any way?
I don't think so. I mean, Polly referred earlier to his fondness for the high life. I actually took him to meet my local Duchess when he came to Scotland, and he... But we went round Bow Hill House and he admired the pictures. I mean, he was a man of considerable learning. And as for his notorious fondness of wine, I'll tell you a story. We, during the alliance, and now I'm jumping forward, but we used to lunch or dine together. And the deal was that he would pay and choose the restaurant one fortnight and I would pay and choose the restaurant the next. But of course, he knew far more restaurants in London than I did. And I was running out of places to take him to. And I went to a Chinese restaurant, in a basement restaurant in Fulham, when the proprietor, I admired the wine that he'd poured, and he said, if you bring Mr. Jenkins here, I will give you another bottle of this excellent wine. So I said to Roy, I'm afraid the restaurant's not particularly good, but the wine is very good indeed. I got there early and I sat down, and down the tiled stair came Roy, looking a bit sort of worried about this restaurant, sat down, and the waiter came along and produced the bottle of wine and showed it to Roy. And Roy turned to me and said, I thought you said this wine was very good. And I thought, I've made a real bloomer here. He said, it's not very good, David. It is spectacular. And we had a great evening.
In the war, he served with the Royal Artillery and then at Bletchley Park. He had his first try for Parliament in Solihull, where, even in 1945, he failed. He then failed in an application to be a BBC Talks producer. And I've often wondered, Polly, would the world have been different? Would the BBC have been different if his career had gone that way?
I don't think he'd have stuck it, actually. I think politics really was his destiny and in his blood. People who have it in their blood, that is their art and their skill. Much underestimated, and he was a great master of it.
I should mention that by now he's been elected to Parliament, first for Southwark Central, then in Birmingham, Stechford. What was his relationship, Dick, with Harold Wilson?
Well, it was mixed. I think he started by not thinking very much of Harold Wilson.
He was a great Gateskillite at first.
He was a great Gateskillite, and he backed Brown for the leadership instead of Harold Wilson. But in office, particularly when he was at the Treasury, and Wilson was at the nadir of his career, Lord King had called for Wilson to be deposed, and everyone saying Roy must make a statement, because Roy was the obvious successor. We had a private meeting in the Treasury with two of his principal advisers and myself, and the other two said, Roy, you've got to make a statement, likely. You've got to say you are behind Wilson. And he thought for a long time and said in a rather bad-tempered way, no, I won't. I'm not going to say I respect Wilson because I don't. Later on, he grew considerable respect. I'm not going to make a statement. He just wasn't going to lie. He said, there's been too much lying and deceit in this administration. I'm not going to add to it.
I remember him getting in touch with me. Polly's mentioned the abortion bill. And he actually sent me to see the junior minister, Dick Taverne. Do you remember that, Dick?
And yes, I actually put you, can you support either abortion reform or homosexual law reform?
Right, yeah.
And you said, I can't do the homosexual law.
Given too controversial.
Too controversial. and abortion law, of course, wasn't.
And by the time we'd got the legislation through, because it took 18 months, he'd moved to the Treasury, and we had a party, remember, in the Treasury to celebrate.
But how responsible was he? Home Secretaries don't actually initiate legislation like this. Why is it attached to his name?
It was, if you like, it was on his shopping list of things that he wanted to see done. Mm. And it's quite true, he wasn't involved in the cause. I mean, you had six other private members' bills attempting to change the law on abortion. They'd all got good support, but they lacked time. And I was number three in the Speaker's ballot for bills. And he was very keen that I should take up something from his shopping list. Mm. Put it like that. He wasn't pushing for any particular item on his agenda. So he wasn't directly involved in the cause or the drafting of the legislation or anything like that. But his support within the government was crucial, particularly when we ran out of time and had to argue for more time.
Without him, these reforms wouldn't have happened.
That's right.
This was not a Liberal cabinet. He had to fight very hard. All of these Liberal reforms, remarkable list, within less than 2 years, were all down to him. He really changed the culture and the climate of the times. When people say the permissive 1960s, they mean Roy Jenkins.
Yes, and in fact, even his critics agree with that. In Peter Hitchens said that Roy Jenkins was the point at which everything went wrong. He also introduced new rules about parole in the prison system. Let's hear him talking about what he has to say about parole.
What people have to remember is that everybody, practically everybody in prison, has to come out sometime. They have to mingle with society sometime. Society at some stage has to take the risks of their being reabsorbed into society. Now, it's every bit as much in the interests of society as of the prisoner that he should come out at the time when the chances of his settling back into an honest civilian life are at their highest.
This is BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and you're listening to Great Lives, where Polly Toynbee is arguing the cause of Roy Jenkins. Also with us, we have Dick Taverne and David Steele. Now, look, we're talking about a Liberal reforming politician, and we've got a Liberal Social Democrat columnist to propose him, one of his former ministers, plus a former leader of the Liberal Party as expert witnesses, all chaired by me, a gay broadcaster, to assess this Liberal Home Secretary. And if I were Peter Hitchens, I'd be going absolutely ape. So I'm not going to let the case against Roy Jenkins go by default. He was a clever man, we agree. He had spine, courage, charm, all those things. But he was going with the flow of a society that was changing anyway, and he was perhaps just a little bit cleverer and a little ahead of the game where most of his colleagues were behind. He saw the way history was moving, and he was tough enough to nail his colours to the mast, but he would come home to the company and the friendship of people who thought that all progressive right-thinking people agreed that these things were right. And how did he really stick his neck out? Did he ever throw himself against the tenor of his times? Well, that's what takes real courage, when society's moving one way to try to go the other.
That's a very ahistorical view. It's very hard to cast one's mind back to 1966. But at that time, there was strong opposition to these things. They weren't easy. I mean, you know, David Steele here will testify. You never had an easy time. It's still not easy to hold on to some of these reforms. I mean, abortion is brought back time and time again. I think it's easy to forget. Once a liberal reform is passed, everybody says, well, of course. But until it is, it's a fearsome battle. And he fought those battles, particularly in the cabinet, which was not liberal. People like Callaghan were not much interested in this. Most of the Labour Party thought it was rather sort of middle-class stuff and not serious stuff of working-class politics. Wouldn't have happened without him.
But they were all foot draggers. I persist in thinking that the tenor of the times was on his side and he knew it.
I don't agree with you, Matthew. I really don't remember the late 60s as being full of people going around saying we must have homosexual law reform, we must have abortion law reform. Nonsense. It was actually hard fought on each and every occasion.
And look at his part he played in bringing the SDP about. I mean, that took guts to break with your party. It's not an easy thing to do. I mean, I know from personal experience you get an awful lot of abuse if you break with your party. Oh, he showed lots of guts.
Why did you leave your party, and did that take guts?
Well, I had a party which, from the start, when I was first selected, was very much a left-wing party, and I was a Social Democrat. We broke over two things, trade union reforms and entry into the European Union, or common market as it then was. And Roy actually very nearly joined me at that stage, and I put it to him that if he did join me, there was a poll which said that a Jeremy Thorpe, Roy Jenkins-led party would have 12 million voters in support. And he toyed with the idea in 1973 of supporting me in my by-election, which would have meant expulsion from the Labour Party and starting it then. But he decided not to, probably wisely, because his colleagues in the Labour Party weren't ready for it.
So here's a man who's been absolutely determined on high office from a pretty young age. He's a huge success as Home Secretary. He's a huge success as Chancellor of the Exchequer. One would think he was heading to number 10, and he ends up President of the European Community. What happened?
Well, it's pretty remarkable that you can leave behind such a legacy without ever being Prime Minister. I'm not sure he would have been a good Prime Minister. In the end, perhaps just because it came too late, he was not a very good leader of the Social Democratic Party, and that's a rather less taxing job than being Prime Minister.
Why not?
I think he'd been used to standing at the dispatch box as a magnificent Home Secretary, as a magnificent Chancellor of the Exchequer, when he suddenly found himself on the margins, being barracked by all sides, Dennis Skinner particularly, really poisonous barracking. He lost his nerve, and he never quite regained it. Of course, if he'd become leader back instead of Callaghan, then it might have been a very different...
I don't think so. I think that he couldn't have been leader after 1970 because the Labour Party turned against Europe. He was very strongly pro-Europe.
This, of course, was the time when the Tories were pro-Europe and Labour was largely anti. Yeah.
Well, he led the Labour vote in favour of entry, and if he hadn't been so strong, I bet we wouldn't have got in.
Absolutely. But I also think that Paul is right in pinpointing his difficulty in the House of Commons with the SDP. You said he wasn't a very good leader of the SDP. I think he was a great leader of the SDP, but what you mean was in the House of Commons, he somehow faltered because, I mean, I know what it's like. You have a minority number of colleagues round about you and you get shouted at from both sides. And it's a very different position from having the command of a dispatch box with hordes of people behind you. You're right. He lost his nerve. He didn't like it. It was a very uncomfortable place for him to be after the successes that he'd had at the dispatch box.
I think to be Prime Minister, he would have to capture the stronghold from within. I don't think he was ever a leader who was likely to capture the battlements by persuading the peasants to put their ladders against the wall and braving the burning oil. I don't think he was that kind of figure.
And he had, after all, for a long period, and perhaps intending it to be permanent, left the Citadel completely and gone off to Europe. Yeah. What were his achievements, very briefly, as president of the European Community?
Well, I think he was a good president, though not an enormously successful president, but his greatest legacy there was that he resurrected the idea of a European monetary system, and as both Helmut Schmidt and Giscard d'Estaing later acknowledged, without him you probably would not have had, at least not so early, the Eurozone, which for the rest of Europe has been a great success. I mean, we've kept out for good reasons or bad, but he was, in a sense, the original architect of what developed into the European currency. So he left a big legacy there.
I think it was not the job he quite expected. I think that he thought it was something you could lead, where in fact you have to bargain and negotiate. The Eurosceptics, of course, regard this as some sort of monstrous tyranny with an emperor who can command, but it's not at all like that. I don't think he enormously enjoyed it.
So he comes back, and this is the last aspect of Roy Jenkins' life with which we should get to grips. His attempt to break the two-party stranglehold, first outlined in 1979, when he was asked to deliver a lecture on the BBC.
The BBC asked me if I would give the next Dimbleby lecture. I was then president of the European Commission in Brussels, and I accepted with enthusiasm. You know, if you're given the opportunity to address 2 million people for nearly an hour in prime time on BBC One, anybody who's in their right mind take it fairly seriously. But in a sense, exactly what I said evolved as I wrote it.
But how long had it been brewing before that? How long had the idea been in your mind?
Well, I think if I look back, my disenchantment with the rigid two-party system of British party politics began fairly early in the 70s. This sort of rigid, sterile, conventional game, which was like sort of 18th century minuet performed in the mid-20th century, and therefore I began to think the system was rotten, and I used this opportunity in 79 to say so.
How do you react, Polly, just to hearing his voice again?
He was somebody who never talked down to anyone, whether they were younger or less well-educated. He was a brilliant campaigner. We haven't said how wonderful he was on the doorstep. When he nearly won Warrington, which was astonishing, and did win Hill Head, he never talked down, and people warmed to him hugely.
He had
a little clicker in his pocket. He was a great one for counting things. And every single person he ever shook hands with in a by-election campaign, he clicked. And he got round to something like half of all the people in Hill Head he got round to with his clicker, and it worked.
Did he have personal warmth, David?
He was funny, gossipy. No, he had great personal warmth. And I went to see him just before the Dimbleby election. In fact, he asked me to dinner, and we sat alone and discussed the possibility of forming a new party. And now I'm criticised because at that stage I should have been asking him to join the Liberal Party. We discussed all that, and many people have written about it. He's written about it. I've written about it.
He speaks in his autobiography of his great eagerness to see you when he came back from Europe. He later talked of you as a remarkably buoyant young man, and it all sounds pretty positive and pretty all part of the same team. And then rivalry rears its head in the decision who should be leader of the breakaway group. Tell us about
it. It wasn't rivalry, because the great advantage of our partnership was that he was much older. He had all that experience under his belt, which I didn't have. And therefore, I thought we made a very good combination. I had the advantage at that time of the public popularity after the 79 election. I was younger. I was probably a bit quicker on television than he was. And the only problem was, and I slightly blame David Markham for this, that he had saddled Roy with this unfortunate title of Prime Minister Designate, which none of us had ever discussed in either party, and which sounded pompous and was pompous and was actually a bit silly. And it became a bit of a problem during the election campaign. But it wasn't rivalry.
That wasn't how it looked from the outside. I can remember those days. It didn't look an entirely happy ship. There were rows, maybe not between you and him, but for instance, Polly, between Roy Jenkins and David Owen. These were serious, weren't they?
They were serious, yes. The Gang of Four was an always rather uncomfortable creature, really, and there was a lot of internal tension. Well, there always is in all political parties. Just because you start a new party doesn't mean you've suddenly reinvented human nature and the nature of politics. And so there were some pretty bloody battles, and there was definite rivalry between Roy Jenkins and David Owen, which started in the beginning when Roy Jenkins made the great mistake of trying to have a constitution of the new party where only the MPs would vote for who the leader was, and most of the MPs were Jenkinsites. And then, of course, it turned out that David Owen was really quite profoundly anti-European, and this was very much a pro-European
Not
party.
Not only anti-European, but he was rather anti-liberal. Roy, I think, soon realised that there was no room for four separate parties in British politics. There had to be a new left-of-centre party. David Owen didn't want to have any really discussions with the Liberals. He could see it as a sort of alliance, yes, temporary alliance, but he really wanted to go his own way.
It looks quite a mess from the outside.
well said of all politics. I mean, I must say that at that time, the division between the wets and the dries in the Conservative Party, between the right and the left in the Labour Party, you have to get back to that state of mind where we were, you know, this party was launched when Michael Foot on one side was one choice and Mrs. Thatcher the other. The space in the middle was vast.
Also easy to forget that in 1983... the alliance very nearly broke through.
Absolutely.
I mean, at one stage it was ahead of Labour in the opinion polls.
But for General Galtieri and the Falklands, I think we would have done.
This is the last question that I want to come to. They did very nearly break through. I remember writing a column at the time saying that there was no fire yet, but the undergrowth was tinder dry. And we Conservatives, we were very, very afraid.
And you were very naughty in the West Derbyshire by-election.
Oh, that's another story.
Well, you had every reason to be afraid.
Yes.
The SDP Liberal Alliance got within 2% of Labour. And had they overtaken Labour, it would have been the end of the Labour Party, even though Labour would have had many, many more seats. It was that close.
But other voices in the Labour Party didn't break, didn't leave. Roy Hattersley didn't go. Tony Blair was, so far as I know, never really tempted. They resolved to reform the party from within, and it may be claimed that they did. So weren't they right to stay, and wasn't he wrong to go?
That is the long argument that still goes late into the night from time to time about whether or not the SDP split made Labour come to its senses a bit quicker than it did, or whether it made it slower and harder. I still think that Gordon Brown and Tony Blair's creation of New Labour and making the Labour Party electable again came from the ideas of the SDP. And Roy Jenkins was very much, sadly only for a short time, a mentor to Tony Blair. Sadly, he turned his back on him. And I think Roy Jenkins felt quite betrayed and disappointed by Tony Blair.
And returned to his books. We haven't mentioned his career as a writer.
Well, what you also haven't quite mentioned is his wit. I think as he went on with his biographies, he got more relaxed about them. I mean, Gladstone is full of quips, the sort he'd always making. I mean, there's a passage somewhere where he says that Gladstone very much favoured people with a classical background. This was difficult when, for the Irish Home Rule Bill, he needed the support of Hartington, and Hartington was more at home with quadrupeds than hexameters. I mean, it's a typical Roy joke. He was such a witty man, very quick off the cuff.
Did he think, Polly, towards the end of his life, do you think, that his life had been a success or a failure?
I hope he feels it was a success. I think that people have said often before the old cliche, all politicians' lives end badly. But I think he was one of the very few who could really point at remarkable things that happened that would not have happened if he personally hadn't been there.
My thanks to Polly Toynbee, who chose Roy Jenkins as her great life, and to David Steele and Dick Taverne for helping us sketch that life out. Goodbye.